Okay, this is the podcast on T.S. Eliot and the love song of Jailford Prufrock. Now, I have to admit that the Prufrock page is probably the most thorough page of analysis in the entire course because there's so much information in it. If you've seen the Prufrock page, you know that you just hover over text, including the title, and you'll see a pop-up in the upper right that will give you information, glosses, notes, pictures, explanations of what's going on and what these things mean in the text. At the very beginning, there are three icons there. They say time, miscommunication, and body parts. Time is a big concern, the lack of time or Prufrock's concern about time, right? Every line that has an image about either time or the inability to communicate or this idea of breaking down body parts, breaking down entire people into body parts. We call that synecdoche, where a part stands in for the whole. That's the literary term for it. All of those images you'll see like in the second line of the text, right? When the evening is spread out against the sky, that's got a clock at the end, that icon, so that means time. But if you kind of walk through this poem, you see that kind of the significance of the love song, the Jailford Prufrock, its importance for modernism. But before we get into that, let's take a look at T.S. Eliot's biography and why he is essentially, he's the 500-pound gorilla of modernism. An argument can be made that Prufrock itself is the first modernist text, period, and certainly one of the best. If it's not one, well, I think it is one of the best. Probably the best modernist poem was also written by Eliot, known as The Wasteland, written in 1922. You see it listed on the biographical page. 1922 is a really important year in modernism, and I know I say I'm not a date guy, but 1922 is really important because both The Wasteland is published, which reflects on it post-World War I and reflects on kind of the decay of Western civilization, using old mythology and connections like that, lots of allusions and stuff like that. And also in 1922, James Joyce's Ulysses, probably the most important modernist novel, is also published. So we call 1922 like the high water mark, the annus mirabilis in Latin, the miraculous year of modernism. So if you look at that, you see that Eliot, right, he has a breakdown, his wife is institutionalized. He moves it from 1922, this kind of despair at the decay of Western civilization, to a recovery of religious faith later on in the 1930s, and it culminates in him publishing another series of long poems known as the Four Quartets, where he holds out hope, whereas The Wasteland is pretty much about the hopelessness of recovering any culture in the West. The Four Quartets is far more hopeful because of his newfound faith. Prufrock deals with something different. It's not going to make huge cultural statements, but it is going to look at this idea of this terribly alienated to the point where he doesn't understand the social codes and conventions, and we call that anomie. You see, if you hover over the title, you see that pop-up come up where it talks about how he's the perfect 20th century man and how this is a dramatic monologue, and that form plays into it. That dramatic monologue, the irony of it is Prufrock is letting us know far more about himself than he thinks he is, right? So he reveals his character or temperament. And Eliot shows the kind of intellectual aptitude you have to bring to this text in that very beginning, those six lines that are written in Italian. And this is from the original, right? He's quoting from Dante's Inferno there. Again, hover over them and you see that passage from Dante, and you see why that's important. Eliot never provides any notes for this or any, right? He doesn't concede anything to the reader. Remember how modernism talks about, right, the reader needs to put things together. Well, Eliot says, oh, you don't know Italian? You don't know that this is from Dante? Well, too bad. I guess you're just not going to get the poem. Move on to something else. He requires a lot more of the reader here. And as you go through the poem, you see that it's written in, right, there's no sense to the stanzas. I mean, think of Keats's poems that we looked at, or Blake's, where we see the stanza and the rhyme scheme and everything looks regular. This looks totally irregular. It's not quite Whitman, but it's very fragmented. It's very distinct. Instead of giving you a narrative, because even Whitman tells you a story, this gives you little flashes, little pieces, as if you're in the dark and a strobe light comes on for just a split second. And then it's dark again, and then it comes on again for another split second, and you have to make the connections of what happened in the dark there. And so he's walking through lots of imagery there at the very beginning, right? This idea that he's calling attention to the fact that this is a work of art because he's talking to you directly. Let us go then, you and I, right? And so you get those three different yous in the poem. And let's not go out on some romantic interlude, although at some level this is perhaps an attempt at being romantic, an attempt at actually doing something with his life, but also this recognition that he's never going to get there, right? That overwhelming question. And he says, oh, do not ask, what is it, right? Let's go and make our visit, right? And so in the first 12 lines, he's telling us, let's go, let's go, let's go, but we don't really know where we're going, and I'm not sure he does either. And then this sudden break, talking about in the room the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo, right? In the room makes it obvious that it's some room that is a common referent for both of us. And talking about Michelangelo, right? That's really, it determines kind of the level of culture and the kind of social class that Prufrock is in. Then it seems like he's on this little diatribe, this kind of tangential point about what London looks like with the yellow fog. And that leads him into a discussion about how he's still got time, but he's a middle-aged kind of guy. Right? I normally ask the question of how old is Prufrock? And I've been sorely disappointed in the past, because when I ask that, people usually say, oh, you know, he's middle-aged, about 35. I'm like, oh, that's killing me, because I'm well past 35. I would say he's, you know, we know that he's balding and he's thin and he's worried. He's wearing clothes that are way out of fashion. I'd say he's probably in his 50s. He's certainly got, you know, the majority of his life behind him. But he wants to convince himself that he can still do something with his life. Right? And yet, for a guy who's kind of tied up in time and kind of hamstrung by the fact that he's practically, well, it seems, inarticulate or can't talk to women, or these people really intimidate him. And you get to see these breakdowns of this body, right? And that's the big point of the synecdoche here. It's the idea that what do you do, like, say you're in a calculus class and you get a really long problem. Can you just look at it and solve it? Well, maybe you can, but what do you do when a problem is too big for you? You break it into smaller parts and you take care of those first. And then you can put them all together to make some kind of response to that problem. Prufrock has this problem with just other people in general. And so he never really talks about other people, especially women. He never really talks about women, as full independent human beings. They're just too big, too intimidating for him. They're too scary. And so we get a back and a muzzle and a tongue and, you know, again, backs and the faces and hands. All of these things, right? It's like Frankenstein's monster almost. He's taking all these body parts, and collectively they make a whole person. But he can't address this, and he can't deal with this big question as a whole. He has to keep on breaking them into smaller parts. His hair's growing thin, his bald spot, a chin, arms and legs, leading us to that big significant line, do I dare disturb the universe? I would say that this is probably one of the most important lines in modernism in general, right? Because it fundamentally asks this question. Are you willing to break out of your shell? Are you willing to break out of kind of, I guess you could say that it's analogous to being friend zoned, right? What happens if you risk jumping out of the friend zone? What happens if you take a chance? Well, you're putting that relationship on the line, aren't you? Because no matter what you end up with, no matter what the response is, your relationship will change. And that may mean that it goes away completely. Prufrock can't do that. He can't get past that. He's going to make up his mind, then he backs away, like being at the kind of on the high dive at a pool and walking to the end of the board and realizing that's a lot higher than it looks from the ground and walking back. No, I can't do that anymore. I got to walk back, right? He even gets to the point where he's doing it with time itself. I've known the evenings, the mornings, the afternoons. I've measured out my life in coffee spoons. That is just so sad, right? Voices and music, right? All these pieces, everybody else involved in community. But he's not. I've known the arms already, arms that are braceleted and white and bare, right? Arms, and how should I presume? And that great section there where he talks about how he's formulated and sprawling on a pin. Pinned and wriggling on the wall. That's going to tie back up to when we talk about his necktie being rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. Now remember, he's dressed in clothes that are years out of fashion, right? He thinks he's looking pretty classy, and he may be looking pretty classy, right? He's wearing his morning coat, and he's got these collars, but they're a bit out of date. But what he's really been is like a bug. And as he says, the eyes, when they stare at you, when this woman looks at you, right, she turns you into a bug. And he's going to even tell you exactly what kind of bug it is. Right? And he's terrified of that. He's absolutely terrified. A woman looks at him, and he feels like he's this bug pinned and wriggling on the wall, dipped in formula. How should he presume? And then we get those series of asterisks there. And how should I begin? Think of those, right? Because he's got those five lines set off with the two sets of asterisks. Think of those as him practicing his kind of his line, his rap, his kind of pickup move. And you realize just how pathetic the guy is when the best thing he can come up with to talk about is, I've watched the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows. Holy cow, dude. That is not going to get you women in a bar. That is not going to get you anything, right? That's not, right? He just doesn't understand. He's so alienated, so anomic, that he just doesn't understand that that's not the kind of thing you bring up right away. That's deep and dark and strange. That is certainly not going to be the great icebreaker. And he recognizes that. And he says, I shouldn't even have to talk, right? I should have been this pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas, right? And that this idea of this crab. And he even uses synecdoche with the crab, right? Instead of this crab, it's the pair of ragged claws standing in for it. And he moves on, right? He realizes that he can't do this, but he's got to try. And he's getting a little bit more pessimistic as it goes on. He's going to compare himself to John the Baptist and then realize, nope, I'm not John the Baptist. As he says, I am no prophet. Here's no great matter. Right? I've seen death itself hold my coat and snicker. Right? He's wept and fasted, wept and prayed, But he's not John the Baptist. In fact, what he is, the one positive, well, it's not really a positive thing, but the one affirmed thing that he says he is, right, he's a bug. He's a grasshopper. He's a locust, right? John, who kind of professionally as a prophet, makes his bones by saying, I must decrease, he must increase, constantly talking about how insignificant he is. Prufrock says, I'm not even the insignificant prophet. I'm the bugs that the insignificant prophet eats, right? And that's why death laughs at me. And here's the great fear. Would it have been worth it if she says, that's not what I meant at all. That's not it at all. If you just didn't get it, right? If you misread the situation, would it have been worth it? This paralytic fear. If she says, that's not it. Or if she says, I like you as a friend. That's what I meant. It wouldn't even be worth being Lazarus, right? And as he sticks that other bug in there as well, this dung beetle rolling the universe into the ball. And then this is so important that he asks it again. Would it have been worth it, right? An entire stanza again. And the recognition in the middle of that stanza that it's impossible to say just what he means because he really can't articulate it. Would it have been worth it? Would it have been worth it to be completely transparent, this nerves, right, the magic lantern throwing his nerves, if somebody could see completely through me to see what I really felt? If she would say, that's not it at all, that's not what I meant at all. And in that final break here, right, we get the end of the questioning and the final answer. Nope, it wouldn't have. And I'll tell you why. I'm not Prince Hamlet, nor was meant to be, right? Am an attendant lord. That second line there is a killer because look what he said. There's no subject there. Am, there's no I in that line. There's no self in that line. Right? Amazing, right? This is how insignificant and small he is, right? What he's doing is he's telling himself, I'm Polonius. If they made a play about my life, I wouldn't even be the star of it. I'd just be some bit player there, right? And he spends a lot of time describing himself as Polonius and then describing himself as Yorick, the fool, right? The idiot. I grow old, I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled. And then the big questions, right? Can I fake it? Shall I part my hair behind? Am I going to do the comb over? Because remember, he's got that bald spot. Do I dare to eat a peach? Seriously, dare to eat a peach? Dude, you got... I can understand you're older. Maybe you don't want to eat an apple because of your teeth, but a peach, come on, for God's sake, you can gum those things. I've heard the mermaids singing each to each. I really kind of like, and this is heartbreaking here, right? And in fact, I think that that's, for me, the next line that follows, I do not think that they will sing to me. It stands alone by itself. And in this poem, it is the only single line that stands by itself. There are a couple of two-line stanzas, but here's this single line. Eliot knows what this carries for us. Basically, I've made these imaginary friends, because mermaids aren't real, and we know that. I've imagined these friends, and even they won't play with me. I've seen them, right, forming their own community, like the ladies in the room, like the voices dying from another room, right? I've seen them, but they don't want any part of me, right? And then at the conclusion, this little final modernist move as well, we have lingered in the chambers of the sea by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us and we drown. Those final three lines, they're to us again, the third you of the opening lines. He calls us back to those opening lines. Let us go then, you and I. And what are those chambers of the sea? What are these sea girls? You've just read through this poem. You've just listened to this podcast. And you know what's going to happen next? You're going to go on with the rest of your life. You're going to close the book. You're going to turn off the computer. You're going to do whatever, right? Human voices will wake you, and you're going to drown, right? The world of the poem has gone away. Why? because the poem's over, right? It's that modernist move, always making you aware that you're looking at a work of art. You are not looking at the real world. And yes, oh, while you're in this poem, it's hard not to feel sorry for Prufrock. He is such a paralyzed, pathetic, alienated, indecisive, timid guy. And you just want to tell him to get over it, but oh man, he is petrified. He can't get over this. But guess what? Tomorrow, we're doing something else. Tonight, you're doing something else. You're closing the book. You're walking away. Human voices are going to wake you. They call you to the rest of the world. And the world of the poem and Prufrock himself is over.